Naomi's been real nervous about trying to introduce me, so she's in here. I am Barbara Parmley, a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And it's just wonderful to be here. The beautiful basket in my room when I got there and all the people. I've been over here a few times, and just the environment here is just wonderful. You just can't help but feel excited and the what nice weather that you have. I really appreciate that, too, even though it is raining today. The committee, whenever Lay something or other, I never could get the whole name. I finally tried to kind of just call you Lay when she called me. I couldn't even spell the name, you know. It's like a foreign language, which I guess maybe it is a little bit. But anyway, all the ones that I've talked to and been around, I just feel like I'm at home. And I keep forgetting that I was going to have to speak. And if I didn't think about it, I could enjoy myself and not nervous. But, of course, naturally, I'm always a little nervous. I never know what this higher power is going to put in my mouth. And I'm trusting that my higher power will put the right words there. So you marry a drunk, you just never know where you're going to end up. My home group is in Southwest City, Missouri, which is about 6 miles from our home. Actually, I'm a resident of Oklahoma. That's where we pay our taxes. And I'll fix my microphone. But the closest town with a post office is Maysville, Arkansas, which is about 3 miles. So that's where we get our mail. And that's why my address is Arkansas. But we actually live in Oklahoma. And in the nearest town with a bank was Southwest City, Missouri, so that's where I bank. You can't write a check when you get out of town because you pull out a Missouri checkbook with an Oklahoma driver's license with an Arkansas address on it. And you don't want to get stopped by the highway patrol either because they question that. And the typical alcoholic situation, you know, I'm always talking about Maysville. It's a small town. There's probably around 50 people there. And I always said it's so small, there's only one hooker in town, and she's still a virgin. When I first heard that, I thought that was so funny. It was so appropriate for Maysville. We do have a filling station and a little cafe in the post office. But I've been in Al-Anon since 1968. In fact, I was 34 years old when I came into Al-Anon, and I've been in Al-Anon 34 years. So now you know how old I am. And I love it, are they called lays when you put them on your head? I call that your halo. I don't have flowers on my halo. I didn't wear it up here today. I'm always teasing them when we Al-Anons go to the open AA meetings and there's a lot of smoke and we always want to sit way back away from all the smoking. And I told them, I said, that smoke tarnishes our halos. But I'll just kind of start back when the way I was raised, and which leads me up to this alcoholic that I never ever thought I would get involved with. But back in my day, as a young girl growing up, my father took me to the side. He said, now, Barbara, there's certain things that nice girls don't do. And you can't do those until you get married, and you can't get married until you graduate from school. So I hurried up and couldn't wait to get through school so I could do what Daddy said I couldn't do till I got married. And so finally, when I graduated in May. I got married in August and finally got to do it. And it was a big disappointment, you know. Anticipation is greater than the realization. So anyway, after 14 years of marriage, I just figured this is not the way it's supposed to be. You know, we've had 3 children, And this young man I married was a wonderful man. He's just boring, I guess, you know. No, he liked to spend all of his time doing things that guy things do, like hunting, fishing, boating, everything, and racing. He always got into sports car racing, and our money was going on this and time, and there's never time for the children and I'm here, but this time we had three children. And it just seemed like, you know, when is he ever going to work? When can I be the hobby, you know? But anyway, it just seemed like it wasn't working. And so I thought, now this is just not right. Now, you know, back in it, my thinking is, you know, if you can't fix it, just get out of it. So after 14 years, I couldn't fix this guy to play house. So I thought, I'll just find me someone else who can. So we got a divorce. And when I look back, I never had anybody beg me to stay married. Every time I'd file for divorce, they'd say, well, Barbara, whatever you think, you know. Yeah, that might tell you something about my personality. So I got this divorce, and so now I'm going to start looking for husband number two. Now, I know what I want this time. I'm not just going after you-know-what to get to do you-know-what. So, and I knew there was some requirements there. I wanted someone who would want to be a father to these children, stay home and be around the kids and do things together with the children. I wanted someone who would be financially secure so I wouldn't have to work, because I've always had to work. And I thought, I want to stay home and play house. So I want someone with a good job that's financially secure. And I want someone who wants me for a hobby, you know, so he'll stay and play with me. And so I start looking for this second husband. And I worked for the state of Oklahoma at that time in the rehabilitation department, and we would send clients to the Spartan School of Aeronautics in Tulsa, and I would write this letter to Mr. Charles Parmley, who was administrator over this enrollment of these students, and knew this thing. And so I went to a rehabilitation convention in Oklahoma City, and my boss walks in with this young man with him. Now, this is many years ago, and he introduced me to him, said, this is Charles Parmley. So we sat at the same banquet table, and every once in a while I'd look over at him, and I'd notice he was looking at me. And so after the convention, the speakers were over at the convention, we all went out to party. And I never did mind partying, because I loved to dance. In fact, I loved that music today. It was hard to sit still in my chair. I loved to dance. But I never did care for the alcohol. Now, I'd order a drink, because you're supposed to, but I'd just sip on it till the ice kind of melted down and I could drink it. I didn't mind the mixer stuff. It's that booze, that alcohol stuff they put in there, ruined the taste. But anyway, I'd sip on it, and if I ever drank very much, I would lose control. And I didn't ever want to lose control. And my nips would get lum. And so I didn't like that feeling. So I never particularly cared about drinking. And then I loved to dance. And the only place you could go back then would be at the bars where you could dance. And then I didn't care about being around drunks, because they couldn't dance. They'd either pass out or get in a fight. But, you know, that was part of the deal. But anyway, so after this, as we had this banquet, we all went out to party a little and dance. And this Mr. Parmley came to our table, and we visited, and I always had these questions. Are you married? No. He'd been married. Do you have any children? I knew I didn't want to marry anyone who had some children, because I had three of my own, and I didn't want to handle anybody else's. He'd been married, but no children. Well, I knew about his job. I already knew about that. It was a good job. And but he said he didn't have any children. He sure would like to have some sometime. He said, now, if you're ever in Tulsa, you just look me up, and we'll go out for dinner. Well, the town I was living in at that time was about 60 miles from Tulsa. Well, I made arrangements to get to Tulsa the next weekend. I had a sister who lived there, so I just had to go and visit this sister. And so we went out for dinner, and I noticed that he had this booze. Well, I didn't know that it was booze. He had this bottle in the glove box of his car, and he kept asking me to hand it to him. And I asked him the first time, I said, what is that? And it was called peppermint schnapps on the bottle. And, see, I'm pretty naive. I'm in that era where you just don't know a whole lot about sex, booze, and whatever. But anyway, he said it was mouthwash. And his breath always smelled good. So we started dating. And there was something about this fellow. In fact, my boss told me one time when he found out I was dating, he said, well, you know, I've heard that Charlie may have a drinking problem. I thought, well, you know, didn't act like he was drunk to me. He's always able. He had a good job, and he always was very polite, and he loved these children. He really loved the children, and they liked him. And I thought, he couldn't have a drinking problem. Well, of course, now when I look back, I never did know what he was like sober, because he's always drinking when we were together. So finally, after knowing him quite a while, a year maybe longer, because I knew his name and knew of him before I even met him. But anyway, he said, I've got some land over here on the Oklahoma-Arkansas line that he owned. He said, I was planning to retire there when I retired from my job. He said, I think if we get married, and we'd already talked about this, getting married, and the children were really fond, they really wanted to do this. And so he said, I'll quit this job in Tulsa, and we'll move over there. He had 40 acres, and he said, we'll move over there, and I think I can make a living for us, and I'd like to have some children of my own. And I won't have to drink so much. Well, but then I was beginning to see some patterns here. I'll never forget one time he was going to have to entertain some people that had come from Iceland. They were coming over to talk to Spartans about training some of the students there. And we took them out to dinner. And every time they would take a drink, they banged their glass and said, "Stow." Well, I quit picking my glass up because it scared me every time they banged my glass. I said, "You always," and that's part of this. Well, they stole Charlie right under the table. In fact, that was the first time I'd ever seen him drunk, and scared me. You know, I thought I lost control, and I had turned my life and will over to the care of this man, and here he's drunk. But anyway, so I thought, yeah, this would be a good idea to get away from this job. That's what's making him drink. So I didn't know he was a carpenter. He said, I'll build us a house on this farm. So every weekend, we would put the children. By then, I had moved to Tulsa and was living in an apartment there, and we were commuting on weekends to this farm where he would build this house. And some people, you would say they measured their house by board feet. You would measure this by six packs. He'd go get the lumber in Missouri, in Arkansas, and send me to Missouri where it was you could buy alcohol, and send me to Missouri at the state line to buy the booze, and he would hammer and saw and drink. And that wasn't long after we'd been married that I got pregnant. We got married in December, and then we had our baby in October. I'm always telling people. Of course, Charlie had all these cattle, and that he had some land leased that he had these cattle on. And I remember one time he's taking me out and showing me these cattle. And I said, well, how many cows do you have? I don't know if there's any farmers here, but you don't ask a farmer or cattleman how many cows he has. Because then he says, well, I've got 75 cows, I got 45 heifers, and I've got, and he started breaking everything down. I said, well, Charlie, how many of those things go moo? Found out something else about when you're married to a cattleman. I was teasing about that. I said, when they had a cow that didn't breed, you either butchered her or sold her. So when Charlie wanted to have a baby, I was pregnant in about a month, you know. But, so anyway, here we are commuting, and he's stopping at every place and getting his beer, and then we'd stop the next stop, and he'd have to get rid of the beer. One time I said, Charlie, I didn't know you were supposed to drink and drive. He said, well, it's okay to drink beer. Naive. I said, oh, okay. Why would he not tell me the truth? So we finally got the house built, and I had this baby, and I thought, now everything's going to be fine. You won't have to drink anymore. And so, and he had a friend that had a lumber yard not far from there in Arkansas, and he was working there, and we built these chicken houses. And I'm from the poultry area. I don't, but we didn't grow for Tyson's, but we're in that area. And we had 45,000 broilers that we were raising, and then he started raising hogs and having little pigs, because you could make, when your chickens didn't do good, you could have the hogs, and you sold those litters off faster than you did the cows. Like I said, I never did know for sure how much of everything we had except the chickens. But then we had the cattle, and then I've got these four kids and a husband that goes off to get cigarettes and doesn't come back till the next day. And so it was getting kind of chaotic around our home. And I always tease about my binoculars. I still had the binoculars. Every time he'd go down, we had the hog pit clear down across the draw from our place, but you could see him down there. And I'd get my binoculars. I'm watching, and I see him putting that bottle in the trunk of that tree. And I'm going to make sure he doesn't get away this time. When he leaves, he doesn't come home. I always wondered who she was. I was more concerned about... Now, when you marry a sex maniac, you know what they're doing. So I just knew he had somebody lined up somewhere. It wasn't the booze. It was some other somebody. So I'm always watching. Who was it? I heard somebody talking about mileage in one of the speakers. And she didn't know how far I'd gone. I kept track of the mileage. We had three vehicles. So I wrote down the mileage. And then when he came back, I wrote down the mileage. I thought, she must live 10 miles from here. But anyway, life was never dull. And in fact, like I say, I didn't have any trouble when I told her about this alcohol. It completely dominated my life, even though I didn't drink it. So things were getting worse, and I remember one time the children, in fact, the children had told their father, their natural father, you know, about how crazy their mother was. In fact, most Alateens always say they're more affected by the non-drinkers' behavior than the alcoholics. They knew what was wrong with Dad, and they always called him Dad because he was such a good, he really was a good father, even drunk, he was a good dad. But he'd come in, passed out on the couch, drunk. Well, they knew what was wrong with Dad. Or they'd see him laying out in the hog pen, passed out drunk. They knew what was wrong with Dad. But Mother's in there humming and cooking dinner, and here comes Dad in the door, and I can tell he's drunk, and I start slamming the cabinet doors and cussing kids, and they look at me like, what is wrong with her? And I'll never forget one time, I thought, well, I'm going to leave before he does, and that way he can't slip out on me. So that evening, right after supper, I got in the car and said, I've got to go somewhere. So I got in the car and left. Well, I just went down the road and parked to make him wonder where I am. I know none of you have ever done that. So I'm sitting down here on the road, and it's about 11:30 at night, pretty cool. And here goes, in our area, now, like I say, you don't hunt raccoons around here. We call them coon hunters. Anyway, here comes the coon hunters and their dogs going up and down the road, and I'm sure they're looking over there and saying, isn't that Charlie Parmley's wife? And I could hear the other guy saying, yeah, no wonder that guy drinks, you know. Not that my behavior might be a little strange. But anyway, I'm sitting there for this till about midnight, and I come in. I'm thinking, boy, just wait. He's really going to be wondering where I've been. He's passed out drunk, had a wonderful evening. Nobody to gripe at him, you know, checking his bottles. And our kids, we always tease them. They didn't hunt Easter eggs. They hunted bottles. They'd come in, they'd be out the chicken house, come running in with this, and he'd vodka. But he usually drank orange vodka. I said, well, he's always health conscious. But they'd tell him, Mama, Mama, we found a bottle. What are you going to do with that? Dump that stuff, you know. So like I say, the children finally, when they told their dad how crazy their mother was acting, I remember him saying something, Barbara, you know, things don't change around your home. I may have to take custody of these kids back. And I, oh, no, I couldn't stand that. So then I thought, well, I'll file for divorce. And so I did. I filed for this divorce and came home. Of course, I told the lawyer how awful he was. And I came home and told Charlie I'd filed. And he said, Barbara, and then, well, first of all, I took money out of the bank and put it in my name. Because, you know, I'd have to have something to live on with these children. And so I came home and told him, and so he said, Barbara, if you'll just drop the divorce, I'll stop drinking. Well, that's the magic words. That's all I wanted to hear. So I'm too embarrassed to go back to that attorney and tell him that I've changed my mind, because he'd think, well, what's wrong with her? You know, after that guy must be so terrible and she's going back. So I just call him on the phone. Well, about 6 months go by, and he gets drunk again, and I'm thinking, well, hey, it worked the last time. I'll try it again. So I go to a different lawyer. You know, you want to think there's something wrong with you. And so I go to another lawyer, and I do go through this same thing, come home, and Charlie, you know, Barbara, if you'll just drop it, I'll quit drinking. And finally, before the third divorce, three divorces, other than our lawyers, too, that town, the county seat, they only had three lawyers. But I'll never forget one time I'm hunting him, and it was the day before Christmas. It was cold in our area at that time, and I'm hunting him, running up and down the roads trying to find him. I was trying to find who she was. And in fact, I didn't know that many people because I wasn't from that area, and we only met two or three friends. And so I could figure out maybe it was one of them, and I'd call him like at 10 at night to see who was home. And then when they answer the phone, what are you going to say? You know, so I'd say, I needed that recipe of that cake that you had the other day. So you're always trying to dream up some excuse of why you're calling these people. And if they're not home, she's the one. But in fact, it's been several years. I told Charlie, I said, tell me where you were those nights that I couldn't find you and who she was. He said, are you still worrying about that? Well, now I know he probably doesn't remember where he was or who he's with anyway. But anyway, this day I was trying to find him, run up and down the roads. And in our area, the creek, the roads just go down this way, and the creek goes there. The creek just runs over the road. Now, if it's too high, you don't drive through it. When it gets low enough, then the cars go up and down through there. Well, it didn't look like it was too high, and I started through it, and something got wet in there, and it stopped. And I don't know car parts well. So even though my first cousin was this race car driver. But anyway, so here I'm trying. I did know enough about the spark plugs. If they get wet, you're supposed to dry them off. And so I opened the hood of the car and jerked all these wires off. And our baby that we had, she was in the seat, and she threw her bottle out the window, and it was going down the creek and crying. And I'm trying to get that in there and wading around this water and thinking, oh, I hope nobody comes in and sees me. They're going to wonder, what is that crazy woman doing out driving down the day before Christmas? And then I'm thinking, but I need help. And no, don't let somebody find me. But God, just get me out of this. I'll never chase him again. I mean, you know, how many times? And so I finally got a diaper out. That's back when you had real diapers. And I was drying them off. But when I jerked all those ones off, I'm thinking, I think those are supposed to go back to the right, to a certain one that they came off of. Like, the guys didn't know that. And because I remember watching that first husband do those kind of things. I'm thinking, no. But anyway, I did get them put back together, and it finally got it started enough to get out of that water. And I said, I'll never chase him again. And if I remember right, I don't think I did. But so then I thought, if I can't chase him, I can't find him, why file for divorce and divide everything up when I could just asphyxiate him when he comes in passed out in that truck? And during this time, I had a sister from Tulsa that would come to visit us, she and her husband, and they knew there was a problem. And she brought me some literature from their central service office there in Tulsa about alcoholism and Al-Anon. And I'd never heard of Al-Anon. Back in that time, you know, there just wasn't much said about Al-Anon. You didn't even see a lot about AA. I'd worked in a mental hospital as a secretary there for a few years, and so in the nursing department, and so I knew about alcoholics because that's where they were committed. People that were alcoholic were crazy. So I really didn't know if Charlie was an alcoholic. I just knew he was crazy. That's why I could, now he'd let me call him a drunk, but I never would call him an alcoholic back in his drinking days. But I looked at this literature, and it said something about you need to get off the back, and it's an illness, and all this stuff. And I thought, oh, I can't buy that. So I just said, and it told me about a meeting. It was about 30 miles from our house in this town called Siloam Springs, Arkansas. So I thought, well, I'll put that to the side. And so when I'm laying there in bed thinking about how I could asphyxiate him when he comes in passed out in that pickup, I thought, Barbara, you need help. You better get something done before you do something stupid. So I made a contact with this lady, and I went to Siloam. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard Donna L. talk from Whitney, Texas now, but at that time she and her husband were living in Siloam Springs. But anyway, I went to see her, and she just came out of her. She worked for a lab as a technician in a medical lab, and she comes walking out smiling, and she couldn't know about alcohol. She's too happy. But she explained to me a little bit. She said, you know, I understand how you feel. Now, that's the first time anyone ever said that. Even my folks, I think they were afraid I was going to come home with four kids because they kept saying, oh, Charlie's not that bad. Well, when I was back, you know, who was crazy in that family? Charlie did the drinking. I had the brain damage. But anyway, she made me feel so good. She said, now, we have a meeting on Friday night, and you go by this other little town here and meet this lady, and she'll bring you to your meeting. So, of course, in this area, towns are all small. Nobody lives in the same town. So I go back through this other town. This lady works for a poultry company. And so she comes out of her office. And her name is Wanda. She's my sponsor. And so anyway, she came out and just smiling and says, oh, yes. She said, well, I'll meet you here. We'll go to that meeting. And so I go home, and I read that piece of literature again. And Charlie and I got in a big argument about something. Oh, I know. I think I was supposed to deposit a check, and it hadn't shown up yet, and he thought I'd stole his money. And so I got so angry, and he got angry, and so finally I told him, I said, I read something in there that says, when you make a decision, stick to it. This time I'm leaving, and I'm not going to back out. So I went to the third lawyer, and I filed, and this time he had to move out. I didn't let him talk me out of it. So this Wanda called me the day before I was supposed to go to the meeting on Friday morning to make sure I was going to meet her. I said, no, I don't need to go. I said, I've got taken care of the problem. Everything's fine now. And so she started talking to me about how, you know, I still could carry the problems of living with an alcoholic and the scars of that, and I needed to go. I really should go. And she just kept on and on. I thought, well, I don't know what. Maybe you get a prize when you take a new member. You know, like remember in Sunday school where you'd get a little sticker or something when you brought the new member or something? Or like a Tupperware party, you bring somebody, get a little gift. So she was such a sweet lady, and she was so adamant about getting me to that meeting. So, okay. So I went. And so all the way to the meeting, I kept quizzing her husband, and he was telling me about how many times he would go out on the road and get to drink, just to drink, and pass out. And he said, you know, I'd have to wait till daylight to find my way home, because I wouldn't remember where I was when I'd pass out. I thought, you know, that could be what Charlie did, maybe one of those nights when he didn't come home. And so anyway, I got to that meeting, and at that time there weren't any men in the meetings, and the ladies sat on the table, each told a little bit why they were there. And some of them were living in worse situations than mine. Some of them had husbands in the other room, and they're smiling, oh, yeah, you're smiling, your husband's sober. But this one lady explained to me about the illness of alcoholism, how it wasn't something he chose to do, that he has a physical allergy to alcohol. When he took that first drink, it did something different for him than it does to the normal person. And so when his mind gets set on knowing that if he takes that drink, it's going to feel like this, then he starts drinking, plus the fact that when he takes that drink, the physical allergy makes him want to keep drinking. And I thought, oh, so that's what it could be. Well, because I thought about how I drank, you know. In fact, Charlie and I've talked about that. When I took a drink of alcohol, if I get up and go, like he says it makes him feel, I'd be drinking today. But I would take a drink. Well, I'm passionate for about 15 minutes, but you better hurry because I'm going to be asleep. And Charlie finally learned that. You know? But anyway, and most of you guys know that too, don't you? Yeah. But anyway, so that's what it is. So I thought, well, maybe we could work this out. So anyway, I go home and called Charlie. He was up at moved up to his mom's house. So I called him and told him, I said, I think I know what the problem is if you want to come home. And I told the kids that too. And of course, when Charlie and I married, one daughter was 12, one was 10, and a little boy was about 2 years old. I said, you'd have to be a drunk to marry a crazy redhead with three kids anyway. And then I had this baby. And so, but then, of course, they were 14, 12, 14, yeah. Anyway, they were up there a little older. And when I told them about going to Al-Anon and what they said about the illness, they said, oh, Mother, whatever it takes to help Dad. And I mean, that's the relationship they had with their father, even though he was drinking. He was never, ever out of line with those children. They always worked hard on this farm. Like I said, we had all these different things. And when they get home off of school bus, they had chores to do every night. They didn't have time. They couldn't belong to a lot of the other activities because they had to help with the farm. So anyway, I started going to meetings, and Charlie didn't particularly care about that. You know, when they told me it was an illness, get off his back, there's nothing you can do. And so I did that, and I moved him out on a cot out in the utility room because they don't smell too good sometimes, especially if they've been passed out in the hog house or something. So I got off his back, and I remember one time I came in, he was trying to pick an argument, and I wouldn't argue, and boy, that really upset him. He called Alan on a lot of ugly names. So I went back to those meetings. I said, it's not working. I'm trying to do what you told me to do, but he's dying. He's laying there on that cot out there, and he just wakes up enough to drink and passes out and goes back to, you know, passes out. And I said, he's dying, literally dying. And they said, Barbara, he has the right to die if he wants to. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to take care of them. But anyway, I always did what they said and always believe it. You know, this higher power bit, and we talked about that some, you know, today in that meeting we were talking about. I thought, you know, I always believed in God, but I believe God gave me a brain, and I'm supposed to do what I'm supposed to do. And if, when you're drowning or something like that you can't handle, then you ask God for help. You know, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake. Okay, you ask him to help you. If you're dying at night, you know, then you ask him to take you. So I just didn't think I needed to ask God for any help during the daytime. They said, Barbara, look at your life today. In fact, I said, back when we talked about life being unmanageable, I said, my life is not unmanageable. I'm taking care of these chickens, these hogs, and these kids, and blah, 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 blah. And she said, well, then, what are you doing here? So then I had to back off. So it definitely my life was unmanageable. And that insanity, I'm not insane. I can't be insane if I'm doing all these things. She said, well, Barbara, insanity is just irrational behavior. And how is your behavior? Well, I knew it was a little bit strange, too. But I argued with everything they said. And, of course, back then we didn't have a lot of the literature. I was telling back then our little 12 and 12 was a pamphlet. But anyway, the group that I started, and that's all we knew was working the steps. And the traditions. We didn't have a lot of other literature at that time, so she was very, very serious about working these steps. And I just couldn't believe that, you know, by doing what these steps say, that my life could change. And so eventually Charlie did get curious because I was coming home smiling, and he couldn't push my buttons anymore. In fact, when you hear his story, he said when he finally couldn't get me in an argument, he got curious. You know, he couldn't justify going out and getting drunk. If he could pick an argument with me, then he could justify going out and getting drunk. I thought, well, that's right. I gave him enough excuses, but I didn't anymore. And so he had to look at his drinking, and that's when he finally went to AA. Well, he sloshed around. He had a few slips after he started, but he's been sober 33 years in October, thank goodness. But I've got a year ahead of him. And in our marriage, I'm sure it would have taken a year for me to be able to. He couldn't stand me sober. I couldn't stand him drunk. But I know I needed to learn how to change my way of thinking. You know, I think God just saw some of those crazy people, and they, well, she'll never get here by drinking. That girl needs these 12 steps. Let's hook her up with an alcoholic. In fact, Charlie and I are always amazed. He said, you know, when he sees different couples that's together, it's like God knows who to get together. And today I can give God a lot of credit for a lot of things that I thought I was responsible for. But anyway, I started going to my meetings and getting real involved, doing whatever they told me to do, getting involved in service, whatever they said I should do. And so things were going along pretty good. Charlie had been in AA for quite a while, and the kids were all growing up and going off to college. And we always have the daughter between us. We call her the prodigal daughter. And so things are just going like they're supposed to, and I knew that everything was going to be all right. And then all of a sudden, this daughter, well, in fact, I should have known, got a clue. One time I was going to start some tomato seeds in the spring, and she said, Mom, can I start some? I'd like to grow some, too. So she said, I'd like to put some in my window. So when her plants came up, they didn't look like mine. And I think she's about 13 or 14. And I don't know any more about that than I did about booze or sex either or whatever. But anyway, I said, Charlotte, I don't know for sure what that is. That's what I think it is. You better get out of this house where your dad sees it. So she did. And every evening when she'd get off the school bus, she'd go way down the draw. But this time we'd already moved. It's really odd how things happen in AA and in Al-Anon when you turn your life and will over to the care of God. It's like, in fact, my sponsor used to always tell me, God does not do nor allow to be done what you wouldn't do yourself if you knew the end results. And I can remember we got real involved in AA and Al-Anon, going to meetings almost every night because everybody was having to drive to Siloam to these meetings. And we all live in 20, 30, 40 miles away. So we said, well, let's start one back here. And that's how we got the one in Southwest City. But we were starting meetings all around us. So in order to keep them going, we'd all go to these meetings every night. And I told Charlie, I feel guilty leaving these kids all the time. And he said, well, Barbara, what kind of parents would we be if we weren't going to meetings? So anyway, we're getting all involved in all these meetings. And I can't remember where my story was going here, except I was going to talk about this prodigal daughter. In fact, she used to throw it up to us that she couldn't belong to anything because we were always going to these meetings. She was planning this stuff. She'd get off the bus and go down and, I guess, check in her crop. But then one morning, her behavior was beginning to get a little strange. And about that time, there was I can't remember who it was now, it came out and said, do you know where your children are and what's going on in their room and all this? So I thought, I better check her room. So I did. I found some funny-looking little pipe stuff, and I told her, asked her what these were, and she better get it out of the house. One time I went in to get her, and she wasn't in her room. And so I told Charlie, I said, she's not in her room. She's gone. So we got in the car to find her. He got the baseball bat, and in case he finds her with somebody that he needs to straighten out. And we drive up and down the same roads I used to drive up and down looking for him. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, this is familiar. I'm sure glad he has to do it now. But later she did come in, and Charlie asked me, do you want to say something to her? I said, no, I didn't do any good. Well, what she did, she's always going out the window. So we didn't know when she was leaving. I was setting all kinds of traps after that, trying to catch her, like I did the alcoholic, you know, just trying to keep track of her. But I quit this job to stay home and watch her. One night I went up to find her, and I couldn't find her. And she didn't come home either the next day. And so we didn't know what had happened. So finally we went to the court and went through the proper procedures till she became a ward of the court. And they finally, that week that I didn't know where she was, I think that's when I really hit a bottom. You know, that terror of wondering of all the horrible things that could be happening. And then you think, well, she's probably having a blast. And here I am worrying, no, you know. And so it's like, back to this, you know, God knows the end results. But I want to know right now what they're going to be. Or always that God won't shut one door, but he'll open another. Fine, just let me peek. But they say, Barbara, that's, you don't learn faith that way. But I can remember thinking, is this my reward for doing all, I thought I'd turn my life and will doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing, and is this my reward? And Charlie said, well, Barbara, God doesn't reward. He doesn't reward, he doesn't punish. You do good, you feel good. You do bad, you feel bad. And of course, the longer I've stayed in, I know that God did give us free will. You know, all we're going to try to do is try to get our will in line with his, and it's not going to be an easy chore. I think I don't really want to be a saint when the last one hung on a cross, and that's not my goal. But I was just so angry about it at first, and then finally I had to give up and know that, you know, it's like I say, why me, God, why me, crying, and this voice saying, well, why not you, Barbara? What makes you think that you're different? A lot of parents go through this. Oh, okay. So I was able to kind of get in one day at a time book. There's a page in there that says that when there's a crisis, you go on and do what you'd be doing in case there's not a crisis wasn't there. And you know, when you look back, I can see now where we get started. God, you know, we don't know what we're going to be faced with tomorrow. We only have today, so we better get our strength today and this power to help you cope with what's going to be happening. So anyway, I went about my business, and she was found and put in different places that they keep children that don't mind their parents. And she didn't want to obey the rules at our home. So anyway, today, she's 36 years old. Today, that girl has a wonderful job. She has a daughter 12 years old. She's a wonderful mother, a wonderful daughter, hasn't had a drink. In fact, the husband she's married to, they haven't had a drink either one for 2 years. But she hadn't been in trouble for a long, long time. She's just been a wonderful child. And I said, my kids turned out all right in spite of me. But it's interesting to watch the kind of life she's going to be leading with this teenage daughter coming on. But I said, you know, Charlotte, I said, we've talked about her, you know, because she used to throw it up to me that the reason she was like she was because she never got to do anything because we were always going to AA now and she hated it. And I have to say, you know, I wouldn't be the kind of grandmother I am today if I didn't have those meetings. And today that she's the mother and all, she's, you know, her tune has changed. You know, she's so grateful. And I said, you know, it's necessary. And she apologizes, you know, for the things. And I said, Charlotte, those things that you did were necessary for you to do because it might be something you need to know down the road for your child. And so, you know, it's easier for me to take what's handed to me. In fact, I can always remember about, of course, when you work these steps, and of course, when I took that inventory, I knew I was being punished for stealing that candy bar when I was in the fourth grade, and when they assured me that God loved me in spite of, although I think I didn't. No, in fact, I think that's one of the things that kept me here is to know that God loved me, and the people in the fellowship love us, just like we are. And then I had to look back at my own father. Even when I took my fifth step with my sponsor, and she said, God doesn't change. He loves you just like you are, and just like your own father. And my own father was a wonderful man. In our home, we never had drinking. I had a father that was always there playing with us and doing things with us. Came home from work every night. Everything was revolved around the family and the kids. And I never even heard him cuss. He'd say ding-dong once in a while or something, but he never even cussed. So, you know, I had a wonderful father, and I know that when I did something bad, like when he caught me trying to smoke a cigarette or something when I was little, I got punished, but it didn't mean he loved me less. And so I had to realize that my Heavenly Father loves me just the same, no matter how stupid I could be. But anyway, that was good to know. And when somebody loves you, then you try harder to be the kind of person that person loves. You wouldn't think was at the bottom of the list. And I can remember we were coming home from our meetings, and he'd been sober about 2 or 3 years this time. And I figured, well, I think he's going to make it this time. And so I think maybe he's due his amends. And we weren't getting, that first few years of marriage were not very good. I don't know how it is in most families, but, you know, I didn't know him sober, and he didn't know me sober either. And so it was like, you know, I don't know about this. And it's hard to change. They kept trying to point out to me, Barbara, there's alcoholics here, I hate to tell these, but they told me that when he took that first drink, that's where his coping mechanism stopped. And if he took his first drink when he's 14 and he gets sober when he's 37, whatever he was, then that means he's only 14. So when he acted like a horse's poo-poo, I just thought, well, he's only 15 or 16, you know, and tried to tell myself that so I wouldn't argue. And so anyway, time, you know, here we're going along this road, and I'm thinking, you know, things weren't too good even sobriety, but I'm going to make these amends, and he can make his. You know how we out-on, I'm going to say this, and then you're going to say this, and or, you know how we're always planning everything. So I'm saying, Charlie, I'm really sorry for the way I acted and some of the things I said and did when you were drinking. And I waited for him to, you know, and then tonight we can make up. And he turned to me and he said, you damn well should be. Now, I don't know. know how many of you know Charlie, if you've ever been to any of those big book meetings, and you kind of know his personality. In fact, after he'd been sober about 10 years, I thought, I think it's time now. He's been sober long enough. I can tell him what I think how he really is. So I told him one day, I said, Charlie, you're the most arrogant, dominating, egotistical SOB I know. And I thought, well, I bet he's going to club me or something. And he looked, turned to me and looked real calm. He said, well, Barbara, if I'm that bad, why are you living with me? And I thought about it. And I thought, well, I guess that's the kind I want. I've been happy ever since. I've got exactly... I need somebody that I'm not going to be able to push around. I need... We're not alike. You know, I believe in... I mean, nothing's alike. There's a few things we like, but most of the things, we're just so opposite in everything. I'm very inconsistent. The only thing consistent about me is my inconsistency. He's very consistent. I like round toothpicks. He likes flat ones. I believe in spending. He believes in saving. In fact, I tried to tell him why you have to spend money, because that makes a job for those people where I bought those pair of shoes. That lady can go down and buy a chicken, and I work for the poultry industry. That made a job for those people in the poultry industry. And so I'm helping the economy. And he wouldn't loan me the money to buy a car. If he can't pay cash for something, he doesn't get it. I had to borrow the money. He wouldn't loan it to me. I said, well, you loan money to some of these guys when they want to buy equipment or something. Of course, he makes interest on it. But, you know, he said, I don't loan money on cars. But anyway, so I go to the bank. I borrow the money for the car. He gets his money off the interest on the bank. I said, you realize the interest you're getting from the bank is my money that I'm giving you. Now, isn't that an Al-Anon tale? But anyway, it's a wonder that we, you know, with our personalities the way they are, but it's taken those type of personalities for us to, you know, we finally learned what each one can do and what's going to create a problem in our marriage. That's where we use, in fact, I'll never forget when we started studying the concepts where it says the minority has the right to be heard. And so one time we were talking about something and I disagreed. And he said, Barbara, you sure have been disagreeing with me a lot lately. I said, well, we've been studying the concepts and it says the minority has the right to be heard. He said, now, Barbara, I don't think that's what it means. But the traditions, we've used those in our marriages, and we've finally learned what doesn't work. Money. We always had disagreements about money. So I had my own job. He finally said I could go to work. So I had my own job. So I opened my own checking account. He gives me an allowance every week. And, of course, he says that's so he can get sure I cook what he likes. But anyway, so I get that allowance every week, and he takes care of the bills. And so we had this little system that just works perfect. We never argue about money anymore. He asked me to pick him up something, but it cost a dollar. He gives me an extra dollar, you know, and I owe him a postage stamp. But when you get our age, that's all you've got to think about anyway. But, I can always think about finally working all these steps and thinking, you know, finally things are beginning to get better after about 15 years. And newcomers, it really doesn't take that long. But, you know, I had to have eye surgery. I had to have cataract surgery. That's kind of an inherited thing. And so the doctor said the first thing you're going to notice are colors. So I had that eye surgery, and I took the bandage off of my eye, and the first thing I noticed were the flowers that were hanging on my porch were the most brilliant red. And then I looked at them in the old eye, and it was that faded-looking red, and I thought, it's like a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. You know, I've always been looking for God out here, and that's not where he is. God's in here. And that's where the parents, and that's where the spiritual awakening is. I'm coming to, you know, gradually think we never know what we're going to need, but it's here. And when we need it, it's going to be here. It's like going, that's why I say when I go to my meetings, I go to twice a week for sure, because I got to go in there and plug up the power, keep that battery charged, because I don't know what I'm going to have to deal with tomorrow. And I want my battery charged so I can handle it. And I want that higher power charged and ready to go. And that's why it takes the meetings that it takes. And today, we're always sitting around talking like, you know, how could our everything be as good as it is? You know, things have happened in our life that I never even prayed for because I knew it would be impossible. I never prayed to go to Honolulu or never even thought about it. That was impossible.
But who would have thought that here I am? I never thought that I'd be around people that, you know, I could start, and it's like I've known you forever. You know, you always feel loved and welcome when you're in our fellowship. And I think that's what is the strangest thing when we have our international conventions in these cities, and we just take over and eat all their ice cream and drink all their coffee. And they're so, you know, they don't need any people with guns around to discipline and everything. Everything is just, who would have thought? And I'd love to go to an AA conference and hear these alcoholics, in fact, even at the open meetings, and hear laughing. And you think, you know, those people are supposed to be dead. They've got an illness that kills you. Today, if Charlie, after 33 years of sobriety, if he had a drink today, he would be dead in a couple of weeks because that liver has gotten older and it's not going to work at all probably today if you put that alcohol in there. So they're living with an illness that it kills you. And yet look at them today and the life they have and the families around them that's happy. And who would have thought that something that's supposed to kill you could give you life? So I realized, well, you know, God doesn't make anything bad. It's just what man does with it. And I think that's where we come in. We find our own God. I think somebody once pointed out God could be good, orderly, direction, whatever you want to call it, because we're from many faiths and many religions. And so we don't talk about that, but we find this power, and it works. Because look at us. Who would have thought? You know, I should have been in prison, locked up somewhere, or a mental hospital. But today, you know, to be married, and I love to be married to somebody I'm in love with. You know, when they told me when I came down, I need to learn to love the alcoholic. He's not touching me. You know, that drunk. And they said, Barbara, there's a difference in love and being in love. I always thought passion and in love, you know, with love. And she said, you've got to love him like God loves him. I said, I don't even know if God loves him. You know, but when I'd go to open meetings, I found out that God did love alcoholics, thank goodness. You know, but anyway, you know, to be in love with this person that I've been married to here, he's 73 years old now, still out there on that farm. In fact, I was looking at my bruises. I hope people don't think Charlie's been beating up on me, but we live on a farm and we're always out doing things out there and banging ourselves. We don't have any cattle anymore. That was another miracle. This farm that we had with all the chickens and the hogs and things, and Charlie got so involved in service work and things. And in fact, one time he went off to one of the meetings, and I'm supposed to go out and check the cows, and he comes home and to chicken houses, which a lot of times after I took my shower, I didn't want to go back in, so I just peek in through the curtains to see if everything looked okay. And one time he came home and there was floods in the chicken house. But first he asked me, did you check chickens? He sure did. How come you didn't notice that flood at the other end? So this time he'd gone off to a meeting and he came home over the weekend, came home and said, did you check the cows? I said, sure did. Well, what happened? He has an old truck. It's really hard to shift all these gears. So I would just slow down, and the little kids were on the back of the pickup. They'd jump off and check the hot wires or whatever we need to check, make sure everything was okay. And I didn't have to stop and start over again. I could just stay in that low gear and keep moving. So he came home and said, check the cows. I said, sure did. How come you didn't see that cow, that dead cow? And I said, was it back in the woods? He said, Barbara's laying in the middle of the field with his feet sticking in the air. Needless to say, he had to hire somebody to take care of the cattle after he left. But then he finally decided, we're too busy, I'm going to sell this farm and move over here, and I'll just have to take care of cattle. And then we'll be able to go more. So we finally got our farm sold, and he built us another house. He builds better houses sober. I said, well, make it big. We had to have a living room big enough because we used to have meetings in our home. We'd call the AA and Al-Anon meetings, the people that we'd sponsor, and we'd work the steps. And so anyway, we had meetings in our home a lot. But anyway, we built this new house and got over there. And we hadn't been in there a year when Charlie had a heart attack. And the doctor said, Charlie, you can't take care of cattle anymore. And so, of course, you know, when you're a man that thinks of money. In fact, that was what was worrying most. What would he do for a living if he didn't keep those chickens and all? And his sponsor assured him that, you know, he will be able to make it financially. Well, anyway, he had this heart attack, and we had to sell the cattle. But you know what it did? It gave him all this time to start his big book study. So he started doing all this traveling, which he couldn't have done if these other things hadn't happened. And that's where it goes back to God does not allow things to be done because unless, you know, he always knows the end results. And so I have to, you know, not question what's happening today because I never know what it means in the end. And so today I have faith that I never had before. And I want to thank you again for the wonderful hospitality, and thank goodness now I can just play. I've been kind of nervous about this, so today now I can start playing and enjoying it, and thanks again for inviting me.